D-Day, the 6th of June, 1944, and what we would have heard over our radios that day. That's our focus of this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David Mackenzie.
This is Independence Hall. I'm speaking to you from the foyer in the south end of the hall, the spot where the famous Liberty Bell has rested since 1915. The Liberty Bell will be rung by Mayor Bernard Samuel of Philadelphia. Mayor Samuel.
This great bell, which you are about to hear, was first rung in Independence Hall in 1753. It bears the inscription from Leviticus, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Now through radio, let it indeed proclaim liberty throughout the land and the return of liberty throughout the world.
From Independence Hall in Philadelphia, we return you to the NBC Newsroom in New York.
What you have just heard was the very first time the sound of the Liberty Bell being rung was ever broadcast, at 7:30 Eastern Wartime, on the 6th of June, 1944. That's just one of the sounds the NBC network sent out over our radios on the day the Allies invaded Nazi-occupied Europe. And people most certainly were listening. For the second consecutive week, we'll be hearing material from NBC's archive recordings of its broadcast that day. It's a representative cross-section of sounds from throughout that day, not necessarily presented in chronological order, but assembled in such a manner to accurately convey the flavor of what was heard. Programs interrupted for bulletins, or shortwave reports from London, or merely technical glitches. It was what we would have heard were we part of that national audience, that momentous day in human history.
This is Wright Bryan speaking from London. In the first hour of D-Day by British double summer time, or a little more than an hour before D-Day began by Greenwich Mean Time, the first spearhead of Allied forces for the liberation of Europe landed by parachute in northern France. In the navigator's dome in the flight deck of a C-47, I rode across the English Channel with the first group of planes from Troop Carrier Command to take our fighting men into Europe. Just before we left French soil for the return trip to England, I watched from the rear door of our plane, named the Snooty, as 17 American paratroopers, led by Lieutenant Colonel, jumped with their arms, ammunition, and equipment into German-occupied France. Our group, at the head of the leading wing from the U.S. 9th Air Force's Troop Carrier Command, was met with only scattering small arms fire from the fields, which were dark and quiet as we entered enemy territory. As we headed back towards the English coast, we saw tracers arching through the air behind us and a steady parade of Allied planes moving out over the course we had just navigated to strengthen the ground forces we had left below. In the channel below us, we could see a few ships, but could not be certain whether they were part of the Armada carrying Allied soldiers to the beaches or attacks which were quickly following the first landings of airborne troops which I had witnessed. For 2 days, I had been living with the troop carrier squadron commanded by Major Clement G. Richardson of Salinas, California. His combat crews had been fully briefed as to their initial mission, the course they would fly, and all procedures they would follow. From the moment this briefing began, the combat crews lived apart from the ground personnel of their base, with barbed wire surrounding their quarters and guards protecting them from any contact with outside persons. All day Monday, they watched the weather. After an early supper, they broke up into small groups for volleyball games in their small recreation area. In the early evening, Major Richardson returned from a conference with Lieutenant Colonel Donaldson of Birmingham, Alabama, commanding this lead group. As Major Richardson came within the barbed wire enclosure of his own squadron, he blew a long, shrill blast on his whistle. The pilots, co-pilots, navigators, and radio men clustered around him. "Come into the briefing room," he said. There he stood in front of a large-scale map on which the course was plotted. As quickly as his men were all in the room, Major Richardson said, "Do you know your stuff?" There was no word of dissent spoken. Said Major Richardson, get your stuff and report to the operations room immediately. I'm going down to the colonel to get the weather report. I think this is it. Good luck. The crews began to file out of the room, but Major Richardson stopped them. You ought to get back, don't you, he asked. There was a quick murmur of assent. Then, damn it, get in there and fight. The crews piled in their trucks to go first to the operations office and then to the line where their planes were drawn up and ready to go. As they moved towards the airport proper, they passed long columns of airborne troops, trudging slowly under their full loads of battle equipment from the bivouac area where they had been camped awaiting this day toward the planes which would carry them into battle. General Eisenhower had visited this camp during the afternoon, quietly passing among the men and chatting with them, asking them names and their homes and their jobs. Outside the door of each C-47, the soldiers assembled and checked their equipment, while ground crews and combat crews gave the planes a final tuning up. Heavily laden transport planes began taxiing along in long procession toward the runway. As the first squadron, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel David Daniel of Birmingham, Alabama, began to take off, the planes rushing in swift succession down the runway, Lieutenant General Lewis H. Brereton, the 9th Air Force commander, moved up and down the line of planes, giving the thumbs-up sign to his crews. Meantime, the paratroopers had adjusted their packs, donned their May Wests and chutes, and climbed into the planes. Each was so heavily loaded that he had to be pushed from behind and pulled from above to get up the steps into the plane. In our plane, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Cole of San Antonio, Texas, the senior officer aboard, moved quietly up and down the passenger compartment, speaking to each man and asking if he had everything he needed. As the men settled in their bucket seats, Colonel Cole said, the doc is going to give you some pills to guard against air sickness. Make yourselves as comfortable as you can. Better try to sleep a little. Quiet settled in the plane. These men had done their talking. Now they were grim and silent. The soldier sitting farthest forward on the port side, Private Robert C. Hillman of Manchester, Connecticut, said, I know my chute's okay because my mother checked it. She worked in the Pioneer Parachute Company in our town, and her job is giving the final once-over to all chutes they manufacture. On the flight deck of our plane, the Snooty, Lieutenant John E. Peters of Chicago, the pilot, and Lieutenant B.E. Maxwell of Clay of Michigan muttered soft curses as their motors were slow to start after a long pause on the taxi strip. But when the engines did turn over, they droned steadily and powerfully. Almost before we knew it, we were trundling along past the operations buildings and the control tower, where all the ground personnel of the base were standing. Some held thumbs up. Some made the V sign. Some waved. It was like the takeoff of a big mission from a bomber station, only more so. This was the first combat mission for this outfit, and everyone on the base knew that this was the day. Our ship was leading the second section of the second squadron in the first group. As we picked up speed on the long runway, I stood between the pilot and co-pilot and watched formation lights of the ships ahead of us slowly, almost imperceptibly climbing, then gradually swinging into wide circles. This thing is really loaded down, said Pilot Pete, and as we became airborne, you could almost feel the sturdy transport strengthening its muscles and shouldering its burden, then foot by foot, almost inch by inch, rising above the fields and trees of southern England. As our squadron fell into its formation, three Vs of three ships each in the first section and three Vs of three ships each in the second section, which we were leading, the preceding squadron was already circling the home field, now gaining altitude more rapidly. Other squadrons followed us. Soon the entire group was in the air. All about us and below us was such a glimmering fabric of lights as I had not seen in the 8 months I had been in blacked-out England. Four times we circled the field, its runways and perimeter outlined in sparkling white lights. Through the sky, formation lights of the planes strung out almost to the limit of vision, looking for all the world like holiday decorations stretching down the length of any American main street. As the long procession straightened out on its pre-established course toward the shore of the English Channel, signal lights blinked, and navigators checked their speed and direction with the pilots and began their continuous plotting of position. As we headed toward the coast, the bulky transports silhouetted against the sky as they gently undulated in the prop wash of their companions. Reaching the first point for change of course, our plane blinked its signal light, and Pete said to his co-pilot, "Want to take it now, Maxie?" And Maxie took over the controls. "Right on course, and we're 1 minute early," reported navigator Robert E. Taylor of Altoona, Pennsylvania. At that moment, I left the glass blister in the forward roof of the fuselage, sometimes called the astral globe, sometimes called the navigating dome, from which I had been watching the formations about me, too fascinated to feel the weight of the flak suit, which, like all crew members, I was wearing, or the steel helmet which I was pressing against the ceiling. Down the long passenger cabin, I walked to see how the paratroopers were riding. More than half of them had taken their colonel's advice and were dozing with their heads back against the wall and their feet stretched out in front of them. The others were sitting silently, except for two or three who talked among themselves in whispers. By the open rear door, Colonel Cole waited and said, "It's cold back here with the wind whipping in." I had been perspiring in the crew's cabin up front, but back where the colonel sat, I was glad I wore heavy clothing. More signal lights blinked as we crossed the coast of England and pushed out across the channel. The sea was calm, its steely grayness blending in the half-light with the dingier gray of the horizon. But soon the moon brightened the water and made the ripples below us twinkle. The ship on our wing, its heavy fuselage outlined against the water, but its wings obscured from my angle of vision, looked, but for the high tail fin, like a giant whale rising and falling in the easy swells. Halfway across the channel, planes one by one switched out their formation lights. "Where's all this fighter protection we were going to have?" muttered the pilot. We had not seen a plane outside our own formations, but the fighters must have done their work well, for there was no sign of enemy aircraft about. "Tiny, tell the colonel it's 30 minutes until jump time," yelled Pilot Pete. And the fat, husky crew chief, Staff Sergeant Richard A. Eberly of Indianapolis, whose father is a major in the Air Corps, shouldered his way back to give the word to Colonel Cole. And then, turning my eyes from the occasional lights and flares which glowed on the Channel Islands, I looked straight ahead and caught my first glimpse of the coast of France. I had never visited the continent of Europe in peacetime, and I was waiting for invasion day to visit it in wartime. The pilot and the co-pilot, too, were seeing this coast for the first time. None of us spoke, but each looked at the other. The navigation had been perfect. We could see the beach ahead of us precisely at the point we had studied it on maps, on aerial photographs, and on carefully modeled relief maps. The moon was almost full. Clouds were riding occasionally in front of it, but visibility was excellent. As our strong ship Snooty crossed above the breakers into the air of France, we plunged into a bank of cloud or fog and lost sight of the planes around us. For a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, we were flying formation on instruments. Then we emerged into clear moonlight, and below the rear door of the plane, almost close enough, it seemed, to step out without a parachute. The small fields looked peaceful with their orderly hedgerows. It almost seemed you could see the furrows. Now the paratroopers were on their feet, each adjusting his packs and snapping his ripcord over the static line, a cable which ran along the center of the cabin ceiling so that each chute would open automatically as its wearer jumped through the door. "You all set?" asked the colonel. "Get this thing hooked for me," he said, as he took his own place closest to the door. The jump lights, a small bank of signal lamps, were gleaming beside the door. They blinked as the pilot threw his switch, and before I could look up, they began jumping. I wanted to know how long it would take the 18 men to jump. I tried to count 101, 102, 103 to estimate the number of seconds. Before I had counted to 10 seconds, may have been 11 or 12, but no more, our passengers had left us, all but one of them. The paratroopers shoved each other so swiftly and heavily towards the open door that they jolted against the door frame. One man among the last half dozen hit the rear of the door so heavily that he was thrown into the back of the cabin and dazed. The men behind shoved him aside and went on jumping. Before the unhappy soldier could get to his feet, our plane was well past the drop zone, and in a matter of minutes it was back over the water and setting a course for home. It was too late, and that soldier had to return with us. He was unconsolable. He thought his comrades might think him yellow. The plane crew assured him that they would think no such thing, but he sat moody and glum all the way back and appealed for lonely instructions when he returned. As soon as I had watched the jumps from the rear door, I ran back to the front of the ship and looked straight back from the glass dome. Tiny streams of tracer bullets were curving upward from the ground, but they were well behind us. One of the pilots in our squadron had unwittingly left on his formation lights, and the tracers came closest to his wingtips. But we saw nothing that looked like heavy ack-ack except in the far distance. Our course had been well plotted and navigated to avoid the known German batteries. We were over France only 11 minutes. With our ships lightened by unloading their cargo, we picked up speed and streaked for home. Behind us, we could still see the tracers and an occasional flare. Below, a few more ships, but we couldn't tell just what they were. The Battle of Europe had begun, and our squadron had delivered the first Allied foot soldiers to their scene of action. This is Wright Bryan in London, returning you to New York.
You have just been listening to NBC's war correspondent, Wright Bryan, the first man to come back from the invasion and make a report to America by air. Wright Bryan is from NBC's WSB in Atlanta, Georgia. He is also managing editor of the Atlanta Journal.
You've just heard Robert St. John, NBC commentator, speaking from New York. And now we present Alex Dreyer, the last American reporter to leave Germany before the war. We take you now to Chicago and Alex Dreyer.
This NBC reporter was stationed in the Nazi Reich through 1940 and 41, until some 14 hours before Pearl Harbor. I had gone behind the German armies as they swept through Belgium, Holland, and France, and I was on the French Channel coast when the Luftwaffe initiated the long, enduring blitz of London. Never had I seen such confidence, such cockiness, such surety of purpose, as was exemplified in the expressions of those Nazi pilots. There was never a doubt in the minds of those fanatical Germans that this was the beginning of the great Nazi empire, which Hitler had preached to them about so often. Back in Berlin, German civilians, tired of the war even at that stage, thought that the Blitz in Britain might bring the war's termination. When I left Germany on the 6th of December in 41, the retreats in Russia had just begun. The Nazis were just beginning to learn the bitter taste inherent in that butter of butters, butter for cannon. What is now happening in Western Europe is what the German civilian, contrary to the Nazi propagandists, has always expected ever since the Battle of Britain was won by the RAF. The Nazi can no more escape defeat than he can escape history, and no one is more aware of that axiom than is the average German. Poised against the Allied invading forces in Western Europe are some 800,000 to 900,000 Nazis positioned in the Low Countries and France. And in France proper, there are probably no more than 600,000 Nazis. The general area selected by the Allied command as the initial point of landing in the liberation of Europe lies some 100 miles from England. This is the Normandy coast, with rather fair landing places for our shallow draft landing barges. If the Le Havre area is now receiving the brunt of the Allied attacking force, it is appropriate for reasons other than those of general military strategy. This is the port where the British, in their hurried flight from France, left enough stores behind to feed a BEF for 5 years on the soil of Western Europe. I was at that port not long after the British had left it. I saw foodstuffs of all description. There was everything from Dole Hawaiian pineapple to California packing tomatoes. In the British officer's mess, dishes were still on the table, half filled with food, underscoring the hurried departure of the ill-equipped English. Now Allied armies are hitting back and in the same area. The Le Havre area is where I saw the Nazis assembling barges and boats of all description for an invasion of their own. at a Nazi officer's party in the summer of 1940 along that strip of France, a Nazi major boasted that the jewel, which was England, would be Hitler's inside of 10 weeks. That was when the famous Tote organization was constructing airfields so fast in France that even Goering at one time did not know the exact number of fields which were at his disposal. Planes of every type were poured into France and stationed at strategic points all along the coast. Back in Berlin, we foreign correspondents stationed in the Reich capital were told that we would soon be crossing the Channel as guests of the Nazi Reich in the invasion of another country. Now against the area from which the Nazis had hoped to launch their invasion, Eisenhower's forces of liberation are directing their initial weight. While the cliffs on the West Normandy coast are precipitous, the landing places are almost ideal. The distance between Abbeville and Le Havre is about 100 miles. This means that the Allies may be using the rivers Seine and Somme, which enclose that area, as natural defenses for their flanks as they press inward. The first German defense lines have already been cracked, and the men in those lines are the so-called do-or-die Nazis. And if we can judge by the initial reports, it would seem that a number of them have already died. In no other way could we have penetrated so deeply, so quickly, and maintained our position. It was at the Somme estuary near Abbeville that the Germans in May of 1940 first broke through to the English Channel, splitting the Allied armies in two. The break was followed by the surrender of Belgium, then the catastrophe at Dunkirk, and then the capitulation of France. The Allied capture of Le Havre would give the Allies one of the best harbors along the coast of France, and its support the Allies will need to furnish the necessary military blood, which is men and machine, necessary for the prosecution of the drive. Of all the ports held by the Nazis along the coast, Le Havre is the closest to Paris, only about 100 miles distant. Obviously, the Allied objective is military as well as psychological. With the fall of Rome as signified for the Italian campaign, the fall of Paris would signify on an even broader scale in the campaign now underway in the west of Hitler's fortress. And now, we return you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
You've just heard Alex Dreyer, the last American reporter to leave Germany before the war, speaking from Chicago.
We announce a special feature of the NBC coverage of the invasion. Tonight at 8:30 over station WNBT, NBC Television will bring you a program featuring H.V. Kaltenborn and a special Signal Corps pre-invasion film, WEAF, New York.
The National Broadcasting Company brings you a program of songs by Tommy Taylor.
It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around, finally found somebody who could make me be true, could make me be blue, even be glad just to be sad thinking of you. Some others I've seen might never be mean, might never be.
This is the National Broadcasting Company in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, we will bring you bulletins just as soon as they are made available. In the meantime, we invite you to listen to music by the NBC Orchestra. We suggest you stay tuned for later developments.
For nobody else gave me a thrill. With all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you, wonderful you, had to be you.
Thank you.
sad room. Don't please my folks too much. Don't laugh at my jokes too much. People will say we're in love. Don't sigh and gaze at me. Your sighs are so like mine. Your eyes mustn't glow like mine. People will say we're in love. Don't start collecting things. Give me my rose and my glove. Sweetheart, they're suspecting things. People will say we're in suspecting things. People will say we're in
This is the NBC Newsroom in New York, and here is Mr. H.V. Kaltenborn.
A bulletin from London. Military observers said today that a general Russian offensive, coordinated with the Anglo-American attack from the West, may be launched within the next 48 hours and almost certainly will begin before the weekend. That is exactly what the Germans have been expecting. That is why they launched their counteroffensive north of Jassy in Romania. That is why they have concentrated every possible military effort of which they were capable into developing that offensive into a major attack. In that attempt, they have failed. The Russians have now had some 4 weeks in which to marshal their forces, develop their transportation, prepare their troops for the next great effort on the Eastern Front, and in accordance with the decisions reached by the Allied chiefs of state at their meetings in Moscow and Tehran, that offensive was sure to be coordinated with the launching of our offensive in Western Europe. And so, before the week is out, the Nutcracker, driving against Hitler's forces from east and west, will be in effect.
Thank you, Mr. Kaltenborn. We now return you to our regularly scheduled program by Tommy Taylor.
Seconds, we will take you to London for the first eyewitness account of the actual invasion of France by sea, of the landing of Allied troops on a French beachhead. War correspondent George Hicks saw those landings from the bridge of an Allied warship, and through the ingenuity of radio wire recording, the National Broadcasting Company is able to give you the story as witnessed by George Hicks in a pool broadcast. So, now NBC takes you to London for the first eyewitness account of the actual invasion of Europe. NBC in London.
I'm in the crowd, I...
Ladies and gentlemen, we had hoped at this time to bring you an account of the actual invasion of France by sea, of the landing of Allied troops on a French beehead. We take you to London.
Screen over the sky, but which is not thick nor heavy and not low enough to be an inconvenience to bombing. The LCTs and the LCIs have begun to pass along the side of us. Those are the amphibious beach landing craft that carry the tanks, trucks, bulldozers, and finally the men ashore. They've been churning along and are bouncing around in the choppy Channel Sea now. And all around us, on either side, are stretched the fast transports at anchor who have disembarked these small craft. They, all over the surface of the sea here, can be seen cutting and zigzagging and then forming into those somewhat irregular lines.
Ladies and gentlemen, apparently atmospherics have again interfered with our rebroadcast of an account of the invasion by George Hicks from London. We again take you to London.
In out of the United States. Hello, New York. Didn't you get that?
The National Broadcasting Company takes you now to Chicago.
From Chicago, the National Broadcasting Company presents music by Roy Shield and the orchestra and featuring Gene McKenna and Richard Page. This program will be interrupted from time to time to bring you the latest news bulletins as they are received in the newsroom. Keep tuned to your favorite NBC station to keep in step with all the latest developments on this Invasion Day. And now Roy Shield and the orchestra open the program with a revival of an old hit, Blue Room.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program to bring you a special broadcast from London.
This is George Hicks speaking. I'm speaking now from a tower above the signal bridge.
We take you now to George Hicks in London.
An American naval flagship, and we're lying some few miles off the coast of France where the invasion of Europe has begun. It's now 20 minutes to 6, and the landing craft have been disembarked from their mothership and moving in long, irregular lines toward the horizon of France, which is very plain to the naked eye. Our own bombardment fleet, lying out beyond us, has begun to blast the shoreline, and we can see the vivid yellow bursts of flame quite clearly, although the sound is too far away to be heard, and at the same time, from the shore, are answering yellow flames as the Nazi batteries are replying. Overhead, planes are high up in the thin cloud, which is a gray screen over the sky, but which is not thick nor heavy, and not low enough to be an inconvenience to bombing. The LCTs and the LCIs have begun to pass along the side of us. Those are the amphibious beach landing craft that carry the tanks, trucks, bulldozers, and finally the men ashore. They've been churning along and are bouncing around in the choppy Channel Sea now. And all around us, on either side, are stretched the fast transports at anchor who have disembarked these small craft. And they, all over the surface of the sea here, can be seen cutting and zigzagging and then forming into those somewhat irregular lines that make a black pencil point across the sea itself, heading toward the ribbon of land that's France and the coast of Normandy. We can see the wreaths of smoke that are beginning to puff up, both black and white, on the shoreline. France, at this particular part of its northwestern seacoast, has a rather shallow beach and then steep cliffs, 100 to 200 feet, and then the rolling land beyond. This area is between Cherbourg and Le Havre. The wind has increased rather than diminished during the night and is now blowing an 18 knot wind, which is pretty stiff, picking up white caps. However, the landing beach craft are going in and are plowing through the choppy sea and seem to be making good headway. The order of the attack is for a naval bombardment, an air bombardment, and then landing craft going in carrying tanks, then a wave of infantry to take the first toehold on the beaches, and then a wave of the beach demolition engineers who will knock out with hand charges the underwater obstacles and those on the shore itself. It's now becoming quite clear and daylight as 6 a.m. approaches on June 6, 1944. Occasionally in the stiff wind that's whipping around our platform, we can hear the thud of shells or bombs landing on the French coastline, perhaps 8 or 10 miles before it. And the steel plates on which we stand vibrate from the concussion of the heavy guns that are firing from the American and British battleships and heavy cruisers forming a long line right behind us. I can count 22 of the squat, square-nosed landing craft carrying vehicles along one side of it as they turn and bounce in the choppy sea, waiting the exact timing to form their lines and start in toward the beach. When I had first begun speaking to you, it was the shore batteries of the Nazis that had spotted us here at sea and opened up, and our naval bombardment squad has replied to them. One battleship is in as close as 3 miles, and one of the famous American battleships is out 6 miles in her firing position. A duel is in progress now between a battleship lying just a couple of miles off the French shore and firing broadside into the land. The Germans were replying from the land with flashes, and then the battle, the ship, let go with its entire broadside again. The side of the battle wagon lights up with a yellow glare as the broadside goes off, and now we can see brown gray smoke drifting up from her.
And her
gun barrels. Huge mushrooms of black and gray smoke are beginning to pile up off the beachhead of France, directly before us. Probably air bombardment. The two columns are beginning to rise higher than the hills behind them. And to the left is another single column. It just burst then on the top of the cliff above the chalk wall facing the sea, and puffs of smoke are standing up now like plumes. A fire has been started on the beach front directly before us, and now batteries are firing from the beach, flashes of yellow, and the broadsides of the battleships are pouring it back at them. Overhead, high, planes are roaring. I think they just came in and dropped a salvo of bombs that stick on that the hilltop directly before it that we spoke of a moment ago. A mall flight of flying fortresses are passing over the invasion fleet. Bats can hear the roaring of their motors. 36, 38 planes against the wind that's rushing through the rigging of this mast top. Heavy bombardments, naval guns, ships seem to be even closer to the French shore now, hugging in along the coastline and blasting out their blossoms of yellow fire. There have been replies from the shore, but low gray pink clouds have set down over the coast of France. For a moment now, we're unable to see the outline of the land. Although over into the east, the sky has opened up. The loudspeaker on this flagship has been announcing almost continuously. The Spitfires on our starboard bow, P-38, dead ahead. The air support, here comes four P-38s now, following the fort. The air has simply been crisscrossed with the live planes of all types. The tank carrying and vehicle carrying landing craft have passed our ship and are beginning to form their line, which is already pointed toward the French coast. The earlier and smaller LCVTs, which carry infantry and personnel, have been en route now over 40 minutes, and according to the time schedule, should be hitting the French shore in 10 minutes from now. Everywhere you look in this jangled English channel, which is green and gold,
and that, ladies and gentlemen, was an eyewitness account of the actual invasion of France by sea, of the landing of Allied troops on a French beachhead. War correspondent George Hicks saw those landings from the bridge of an Allied warship, and through the ingenuity of radio wire recording, the National Broadcasting Company has brought you the story as witnessed by George Hicks in a pool broadcast. We take you now to Chicago.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worry on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter pat? And that happy tune is yourself. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with the blues on parade, but I'm not afraid. This rover crossed over. If I never had a cent, I'd be rich as Rockefeller. Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of the street. Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worry on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter-pat? And that happy tune is yourself. Life could be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with the blues on parade. But I'm not afraid. This rover's crossing over. If I never had a cent, I'd be rich as Rockefeller. Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of the street.
Some of the sounds of D-Day, June the 6th of 1944, as heard over WEAF New York and the NBC network. That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005. Produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at the same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.